like Andy Thomas, I live over in the US, also working for NASA, and I don't get much opportunity to come back that often, although this year things are a little bit different. And it's really good that when I do come back, to see lots of people who are really enthusiastic and interested and excited about the same things that I was keen on when I was your age. Obviously, you all enjoy science. Sometimes I have to sort of stand here and ask, like, does anyone interested in science? I don't have to do that today, thank goodness. And obviously, you're also very interested in astronomy and space like me. I want to ask, just to the show of hands, who definitely wants to become a scientist or an engineer, they think, when they finish high school? Okay, so there's quite a few of you. And who's at least... who's of those people didn't put their hands up, who's at least thinking it's a possibility? All right, so it's fair to say that almost all of you are actually seriously thinking about science and engineering. And so the message that I want to give to you is that being a scientist is absolutely great. And I'm having a great time just starting off on my career. And today I want to give you a bit of feel of why science is so much fun and what you get out of it. So, like a lot of you, I was always fascinated by space. When I was 5 years old, all the other kids wanted to be in the police force or drive fire trucks, and I already decided that I wanted to be an astronaut. I reckon that by the time I was 10, I must have seen 2001: A Space Odyssey about 20 times, not to mention Star Wars and Battlestar Galactica, which are actually current movies when I was that age, which is pretty scary. So I was pretty keen to be an astronaut, like I'm sure a lot of you were and perhaps still are. And I was discouraged by a couple of things. And one is that to apply for NASA, you did and still need to be a US citizen. And I'm definitely not keen to give up my Aussie passport. I guess it would look pretty bad now, like young Australian becomes young American. But the real problem with me is motion sickness. And anyone who's lucky enough to be in my Cessna in a couple of hours will learn all about that. I'm quite afraid of heights and afraid of flying. And I think that would look pretty bad on the old application form. Want to be an astronaut, but don't like going up in the air. So if I can learn to overcome that, maybe I'll be an astronaut one day. But I found that I was just as much interested in the objects up in space as I am in actually going up there. And you can actually see most of those objects just as well from the ground as you can from up there. So as I got older and began to think seriously about what I wanted to do with my life, I really started to gravitate towards astronomy. So I think it's absolutely incredible that now, many years down the track, I can look at myself and say I am an astronomer. And knowing that I'm actually getting to do this fantastic, awesome stuff for a living is very fulfilling, and I'll talk briefly about the gory details of what I actually do a bit later on. I think the exciting thing for me is that even though I started off in normal astronomy, looking at stars and planets on the ground, just like the sort of stuff you were doing last night, I'm now actually much closer to the space program than I ever thought I would be. The first thing is that you all should know, a couple of people asked me like where I went to uni in the USA. I should point out that I went to uni right here in Australia. I did a Bachelor of Science degree at Sydney Uni, and then I did a PhD in physics at Sydney Uni. So everything I've achieved, don't look at me and think, wow, you have to go overseas to do that. I did all that as a student right here in Australia, and so there's no reason why you can't follow the same path. But I finished my PhD almost a year ago now. I handed it in at September of last year. And when I finished, to my great surprise and delight, I was offered something called a Hubble Fellowship. And a Hubble Fellowship, it's a pretty good job. It's a NASA-sponsored job. It's a 3-year contract. And it's a very nice contract, because normally when you get a contract, you have to like say, I will do a certain thing for 3 years. But with a Hubble Fellowship, all you have to do is astronomy. And you can do it at any place in the United States you want. You unroll your map of America, it's a pretty big place, and you can pick any university or research institution you want. So I could work at NASA if I wanted to. I could have worked at the Johnston Space Center where Andy Thomas was, or I can pick any university or the military or whatever. It's a pretty nice opportunity. You pick the city you like to live in, the people you like to work with, the telescope you like to use, and off you go. And, well, wait, there's more. As well as giving you that flexibility, they also throw in $12,000 a year. This is not your salary. This is $12,000 a year pocket money that you can use on whatever you want. And so I can use that to hire students or people to work for me. I can buy computers. I can use it for travel. I can go to conferences. I can go to telescopes. The idea of a Hubble Fellowship is they say, we think you're actually pretty good, and we want to give you basically open slate, you know, blank checkbook to do whatever you want with your ideas and your time and your abilities. So it really is a special opportunity. And it gives you a chance to try some really exciting ideas and visit some interesting places. There is one catch. There is one part of the contract that you have to fulfill, and that's that what you do has to be related to and have to involve the Hubble Space Telescope, which I'm sure you've all heard of. Thankfully, this policy isn't policed too strictly, because I actually haven't used the Hubble at all in my first year of my fellowship, and it's quite possible I won't use it at all in the 3 years that I'm there, but they're not too fussed about that.
one of the catches is that to use telescopes, you have to apply for time. You have to fill out an application form, and you send it off, and the telescope people decide which proposals get time and which don't. And the Hubble Space Telescope is the hardest telescope there is to get time on. I mean, it's the best telescope, so everyone wants to use it. About 9 in 10 applications get rejected from the Hubble Space Telescope. So far, every application I've put in has been rejected. I haven't got up to 9 yet, so I guess I shouldn't complain.
That certainly doesn't mean that I'm no good or I'm a failure. There are hundreds and hundreds of telescopes out there. I apply and put in as many applications as I can, and half of them get rejected, and that's pretty much par for the course. Doesn't matter who you are, if you're a student or you're a world-famous astronomer, half to three-quarters of all your applications get rejected simply because everyone's putting in so many applications. And so the idea is you put in more than you can really handle because you know you're only going to get half of them through. So in any case, I've got a Hubble Fellowship, and the place I've chosen to go is MIT. And the reason why we call it MIT is because its full name is the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which is a bit of a mouthful, so MIT for short. And that's where I've been living and working for the last year. So this is in a town called Boston. It's a city about half the size of Melbourne. It's in a state called Massachusetts. It's a great city. It's got lots of interesting people, lots of things to do. It gets unbelievably cold in winter, and it gets stinking hot in summer. So I'm not complaining at all that I'm missing out on the Boston summer by having to come here. It's very unpleasant there at the moment. Now, at MIT, I work in a department called the Center for Space Research. Not hard to work out what they do there. It's a very interesting place. Most of the people there are not astronomers. They're not sort of stargazers, people who are actually interested in stars and planets and galaxies for their own sake. But they're a lot of engineers and programmers, and they work on building instruments and satellites, which NASA then launch into space. So MIT is very much involved in the space program. The one satellite that I've been working on a lot so far, and one satellite I have been successful in getting time on, is a satellite you might not have heard of called RXTE, which stands for the Rossi X-ray Timing Explorer. So this is a telescope up in space, just like the Hubble Space Telescope. But it's quite a cheap telescope. It only cost a few $100 million, which is an absolute bargain for a telescope. And it actually doesn't make pictures of the sky like the Hubble Space Telescope. It can't see the sky at all. It actually listens to the sky, and it listens to the sky in X-rays. So it's like putting an X-ray microphone up in space and just listening to the hissing and the popping and the crackling of space and studying the signals that come from space. So obviously it'd be a great way to find aliens if they were signalling to us in X-rays, but we haven't done that yet. But one of the things that we do with XTE is discover new types of objects that make certain signals. And one object that was recently discovered using this telescope, RXTE, is a new type of object called a magnetar, which is just an abbreviation for magnetic star. Has anyone heard of magnetars? A couple of people. Okay, so this is a brand new discovery. It was only found out about last year. It hasn't sort of made its way into the textbooks yet. And a magnetar is a star. Well, all stars are magnetic, just like the Earth is magnetic and the Sun is magnetic. Well, this is a star whose magnetism is about 1,000,000,000 times stronger than the Earth's. So if you put a magnetar as far away as the Moon, its magnetism would still be so strong it could rip the buttons right off your shirt. So unbelievably strong magnetism there. And they're very exciting. I mean, anything that's new is exciting. We don't understand much about magnetars at all yet. I actually didn't believe in magnetars until last year. Some people claimed they were real, and I was one of the people that said they weren't. And once this proof came through from XTE, I had no shame at all about jumping on the bandwagon, a bit like a religious experience, if you like. And I'm now one of the people who are working on magnetars. We're trying to understand where they come from, how they work, how many of them there are, and so on. XTE, this telescope that discovered magnetars, it actually has four cameras on it. Most telescopes have multiple cameras. And two of those four cameras were built right at MIT. So a lot of the satellite data comes right down from the satellite into an office which is on the floor below mine, and you actually see the data coming through. So I've actually been there a couple of times when the instant discovery is made, when you see some amazing new result coming through from the satellite, and obviously that's pretty exciting. The other satellite I've been working on is one that you maybe haven't heard of, but you're going to hear an awful lot about it starting in just a few more days. RXTE, as I said, was a very cheap sort of bargain basement observatory. It just cost a few $100 million. But there are much more expensive telescopes, and the four most expensive ones are four satellites called NASA's Great Observatories. And each of these cost about $5 billion each, so these are seriously big telescopes. So if we just go for the four Great Observatories, there are two up in space at the moment. One's being launched next week, and one will be launched in a few more years' time. So the first of the four Great Observatories was the Hubble Space Telescope, or HST for short. And that was the best telescope that's ever been built at optical wavelengths. It looks at the same sort of light that we use in our eyes and that normal telescopes are used for, but because it's up in space, it sees everything much clearer. And so that was launched in, I think, 1988 or 89, I can't remember. I think 88. The one launched a couple of years after that, the second of the great observatories, was the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, or CGRO for short. And you can see they're all named after someone famous. Rossi was a famous scientist, Hubble was a famous scientist, Compton was a famous scientist. And CGRO was launched in the early 90s, and as the name suggests, the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, it does the same sort of things as the Hubble Space Telescope, but does it in a different part of the spectrum. It does it in gamma rays. So the sky has got all sorts of amazing things up in it in gamma rays as well, and CGRO has been looking at that. So the third of the great observatories, which is being launched on the space shuttle Columbia on July the 20th, which is next week, is the Chandra X-ray Observatory, named after a very famous astronomer called Chandrasekhar. Much quicker to say Chandra. So the Chandra X-ray Observatory, or CXO for short. Has anyone heard of Chandra? Okay, has anyone heard of AXAF? No? Okay, so it used to be called AXAF and it had a name change just a couple of months ago. So if you read about AXAF, Chandra, same thing. Alright, so what is Chandra? Well, obviously it's an X-ray telescope, and it's a seriously kick-butt X-ray telescope. With current X-ray telescopes, and there are a few X-ray satellites up in the sky, you can't see X-rays from the ground because the atmosphere locks them out, so you can only study the sky in X-rays from in orbit. But with current X-ray telescopes, things are quite blurry. XTE, the satellite that I've been working on, the X-ray Timing Explorer, as I said, it can't make a picture of the sky at all. It can only listen to the sky, and so it has very, very bad vision. It's pretty much blind. And another satellite that we've been using lately called ASCA, which is a Japanese satellite, its vision is not even as good as the human eye. So if you put on your X-ray glasses and you looked at the sky, you would actually see sharper vision than this incredibly expensive satellite. But Chandra is going to solve that problem. It's going to have incredibly sharp vision. It's going to be able to see things 1,000 times sharper than the naked eye. It'll give us incredibly amazing pictures of the universe in X-rays and open up whole new worlds for us. Now, as I said, I said 90% of proposals on the Hubble Space Telescope rejected. Well, Chandra is not quite as popular, but almost. It's more like 85% on Chandra. And I'm happy to say that I was quite lucky on Chandra. I put in 6 proposals and 3 of them got through. So I got 50% of what I asked for, which is doing pretty well, given that most people got rejected. So I do have some time coming up in Chandra, and hopefully I'll get that time very soon, all going well with the launch. And I'll be getting back some pictures of my favourite objects in amazing detail, and we'll be discovering things that we've never seen before. So I'm very excited about Chandra being launched, and I'm sure you'll hear all about it in the next few weeks. The control centre for Chandra, like you saw Andy Thomas showing the pictures of like the Mir space station being orbiting, all satellites have a control centre just to run each one of them, and the control centre for Chandra is actually right at MIT in a building just across the road from mine. So once again, I'm going to be right in the thick of things. We're all very, very excited at MIT about Chandra. What you've got to realise is that some of these, I've just sort of come on the scene in the last year, but some of these satellites, people have been working on them for their whole lives. The first plans for Chandra were proposed to the US government in 1966. So that's before anyone even walked on the moon and before me and most of you were born, and it's now finally, 33 years later, about to be launched. So there's people who started off working in Chandra when they first started work, and they're still going. This is their entire life, so it's very exciting. I have to say, the only disappointing thing about talking to you guys and being here in Australia is I'm actually going to miss the launch. All my mates are heading off down to Florida to see it. It's actually a night launch, which is obviously very exciting and spectacular, and I guess, like you, I'll just be watching it on TV. So that's Chandra, which is about to be launched next week, is the third of NASA's great observatories. There is a fourth, which is being built and will be launched in another 2 or 3 years. And that observatory, it hasn't been named after a scientist yet, they haven't picked one, but its name for the moment is CERTIF, which is the Space Infrared Telescope Facility. And that will do, we've had an optical telescope, we've had gamma rays, we've had X-rays, and this is going to do the same thing in infrared. It's going to have like heat goggles, if you like, and look at the sky in them. The plan, NASA loves PR, and while the plan was to have all four great observatories at the same time, but they're only going to just scrape in because the Gamma Ray Observatory has pretty much run out of fuel and is about to be switched off. Hubble is sort of getting a bit old and will be turned off in another 3 or 4 years, and CERTIF is going to be launched in another 3 or 4 years. So they do really want all four of them up there at the same time to say that we're sort of studying the universe everywhere we can, but I suspect that, you know, once they turn CERTIF on, they'll probably switch, get the Gamma Ray Observatory and Hubble off like a week later. All right, so that's just the start of what's happening at MIT. There's an enormous amount going on. You've all heard of the Voyager missions, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, yeah? Yeah, okay, so the Voyager missions were launched in the late 70s, and throughout the 80s flew past the gas giants, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus and Neptune, and taught us pretty much everything we know about those four planets. Now, some of you probably know that the Voyager probes, even though they've passed all the planets and left them all behind, they're actually still going. They're still on and they're still taking data. Now, the cameras have been turned off because there's pretty much nothing to see out there. They're sort of just starting to head off towards the next nearest star.
But there's lots of other probes on the Voyager satellites which are measuring the gas between the stars and all sorts of other things too. And all this is actually being run from MIT. One of the main things the Voyager probes are doing now is measuring the composition of the solar wind. The sun is blowing off a wind that's evaporating, if you like, very slowly, blowing off this wind in all directions, and by using the Voyager probes we can learn about that solar wind. It turns out that the actual edge of the solar system is not Pluto at all. The official edge of our solar system is where the solar wind stops and where the wind from the next star takes over. And that's actually way, way beyond the orbit of Pluto. And we believe that sometime in the next sort of 5 to 10 years, the Voyagers will actually hit this point. The solar wind will stop and we'll be sensing the wind from another star. And this will be the point at which our solar system ends. So we don't actually know how big our solar system is. And hopefully using the Voyager probes, we're actually going to learn that. So once again, as I said, the Voyager probes are being run right from MIT, from the floor which my office is on, in fact. And every morning the data comes through and the guy in the office next to me actually prints out the latest plots and sticks them on the notice board next to my door. So it's very exciting that we're seeing this data coming from these the things that have gone furthest into space of anything that man has made, and that data is coming in into the office next to mine. It's very exciting to be there as it all happens, and I really expect that the moment that the actual signal comes through from Voyager that it's left the solar system, I'm going to hear a whopping big shout from the office next to mine, and we're all going to be taken down to the pub and shouted a round of drinks. There's a heap of other space missions being run and designed from MIT. There's the Mars Explorer. There's WIND, which is a satellite just to fly around the sun and measure the solar wind. Ulysses, which is another solar experiment. Magellan, which explored Venus. Andy Thomas mentioned some of the experiments being done with animals and cells. A lot of those bio labs are designed at MIT and then carried up on the shuttle. It's all designed and run and programmed from the building that I work in every day. So I really am right in the thick of things being there, and obviously that was part of the plan. I did get to choose anywhere I wanted to go, so I picked MIT for that reason. And I'm really hoping I can get more and more involved in Chandra and in some of the other missions in the next 2 or 3 years. So I'm going to tell you a bit about what I'm doing at MIT, but the bottom line is that you really don't have to be an astronaut in the space program. As I said, I did a Bachelor of Science at Sydney Uni. I did a PhD at Sydney Uni, which only finished 10 months ago, and now I'm in the thick of NASA's Space and Astronomy program. And I'm having great fun as well. So I guess a lot of you are probably looking at me like I'm sort of freak. I'm, you know, a bit of a freak, you know. It's easy for me to say I'm having a great time, but, you know, I've got a PhD, I work for NASA, I'm now Young Australian of the Year. And, you know, obviously it's easy for me to say. And I really can't argue with it. What I've done has been very difficult. Research is very, very hard. I think science involves new and sophisticated concepts, and these can be really tricky to get your mind around. Like all research scientists, I'm constantly faced with things I don't understand. Sometimes things that other people have done, and even worse, things that I've done, an experiment that I've set up, and I don't understand the result that's come out of it. And that can be very frustrating. I mean, no one likes being confronted with something that doesn't make sense. But when you think about it, that's what science is actually all about. It's about being confronted by something you don't understand and then trying to work out what it all means. If we all only worked on easy problems, well, that would certainly, you know, give us less of a headache and be less frustrating, but we'd never actually learn anything. Try and imagine where we'd actually be if Galileo had put down his telescope because he really just couldn't be bothered working out what those funny lumps on the moon were, or if Newton had said, you know, apple schmapples, you know, I don't care. The names like Galileo and Newton, they only mean something to us now. I mean, they're household names because these are people who took a really hard problem and they didn't walk away from it because it was too hard. They said, I want to understand what's going on. So, yeah, science is hard, and I'm sure all of you have sort of realised that already in sort of working through exams and all the rest of it. If any of you are thinking, well, science is easy, well, just wait till you get to university. I think there's two reasons why it's worth sticking with, even though it is very difficult. And the first is to bear in mind, you know, no one ever got anywhere by doing things that were easy. Now, I don't know about you, but I have my heroes. And it's worth thinking about your heroes. You know, I'm sure they're singers and artists and sports stars and actors and, you know, perhaps with you lot and with me, scientists as well. Think of the people who you really admire and who you'd like to emulate. And if you know anything about their careers, you know that they've worked really, really hard. None of your heroes have got anywhere just by sort of taking the easy option and bludging. It was years of dedication and training and practice that got them to the top. So hopefully the writing's on the wall for you too. If you're ambitious and you want to be successful and you want to get to the top, you've got to put in that hard work as well. I think the second thing about science is what you get out of it when you solve something that's hard. There's an immense feeling of satisfaction and accomplishment. The time you put into the problem was actually worth it. I think it's really character building to get through a hard problem. Next time you run into something that's hard, you can actually draw on your experiences in getting through the last problem to climb that mountain too. You also learn a lot and your mind is really stimulated along the way to solving a problem. So I cannot argue that science is hard. I think everything worth striving for is hard. And it's immensely satisfying to look back and say that you've done something hard and you've done it well.
So one thing, I guess you're all sort of, you know, getting towards the point where you've got to work out what you're going to do with your lives, which is a pretty scary decision to make. And if you've been going to courses and careers days and talking to friends and family and trying to decide university options and subjects like I did when I was your age, then you've probably got the vibe from people that science is a bit of a bad option. Right through high school, I was really a bit, I'm ashamed to admit, that even though I was very keen on science and good at it, I was a bit turned off from a career because I was convinced that I wouldn't be able to get a decent job. I'm just curious to see, is that sort of vibe still around? Who's sort of been told by anyone, just hands up, you know, don't waste your life in science? Okay, so it's good to see that not so many of you have been told that and you've been positive reinforcement, but I certainly was given quite negative sort of advice when I was your age. I think there are some stereotypes of science as a profession. One is that there's not that many jobs. One is that you're going to spend long, dreary hours stuck in some lab. And another is that you're going to be stuck on whatever topic you pick for the rest of your life. You pick, you know, some detailed topic in astrophysics, well, you better like it, mate, because that's what you're going to be doing for the next 40 years. I don't think any of those things are true. As far as finding jobs is concerned, I think that I don't think you should pick what you do at university just so you can get a job, because you might not enjoy that job. But I think that as far as science goes, I mean, if you like science, that's great, but know that every single person I knew who did science at university, without exception, found a good job in science almost immediately after they graduated. I think it's quite incredible the diversity of jobs that scientists get into. I mean, if you study accountancy, well, you're going to be an accountant. And if you study law, well, no prizes to guess what you're going to be doing. But science graduates end up just all over the place. A lot of them end up working for the government, places like DSTO, like Mark, or CSIRO, or ANSTO, our nuclear division, or the Bureaus of Statistical Meteorology. A lot of them end up working in research and development in the private sector in areas like computing and mining, pharmaceutics, aerospace, communications, and food technology. A lot of science graduates end up being high school teachers, and I think that's very important they do that, because the only reason a lot of you might be keen on science is because you've had good teachers, and if you don't come back in 10 or 20 years' time and pass that on to more students, we're not going to have keen, enthusiastic people coming up through. And others end up in academia and teach at university, which is important for the same reasons. So I think jobs in science are certainly plentiful, and well, are these jobs interesting and rewarding and stimulating? Well, I did that boring old science degree at university, and now I'm working for NASA, so I think that sort of answers that question. Well, again, I said this perception also that research involves being ferreted away in front of some computer or in some cramped lab for your whole life, which no one really wants to do. And again, I don't think this is true. In fact, what I want to sell to you is that one of the main attractions of science is it takes you to places that no other career could ever take you. One of my friends has just finished his science degree and is about to live in the South Pole for the next year. He's pretty excited about this, but his wife isn't. but obviously that's a great once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Another one of my friends has just moved to Chile and is working in the mountains there at an observatory for the next 6 months. And again, that's not a great opportunity too. As for me, well, I've had a great chance to live in the States, in Boston, which is a great place for a few years. And also my work in the last 12 months has taken me to Italy, England, New Mexico, Texas, the Netherlands, all over Australia, and I've got trips to Germany and Hawaii coming up in the next few months. And that's just all through my science. It's not costing me anything. They all are working trips, but they are all great experiences. The one drawback is you sort of don't tend to get any sleep because you're always jet-lagged out of your brain and you're always working very hard, but I think that there's a lot of rewards from getting to just see all these amazing places. If you've got a travel bug, which I certainly have, then I really think a research career is for you. I really can't help but feel that much of what I've learned as a person, aside from what I'm learning about my job, what I've learned as a person comes from all the exotic places and cultures I've had the chance to visit through my work. And even better than that, I've now got people from all over the world who are my friends. While I was living in Australia, not surprisingly, most of my friends were Australian. It's quite normal. But now that I've travelled and spent a lot of time in all these countries, I've got friends and colleagues from all sorts of different cultures. And I also, even when I'm not travelling, which happens some of the time, these people are actually coming and visiting me and using my facilities. So you're constantly being exposed to interesting people through your work, and I don't think there's anything better than constantly meeting interesting people. The other thing I said that you might worry about is being stuck in the one topic for the rest of your life. And again, this isn't true. Because science doesn't teach you about rote learning. It teaches you how to ask questions and how to answer them. So I think a good scientific training lets you really tackle a huge range of different problems. And most scientists work on all sorts of different things throughout their careers. Just a couple of examples. My PhD supervisor, he's obviously an astronomer, and he started off as a geophysicist. Another one of my colleagues, who is also now an astronomer, started off as a neurosurgeon. What's more, all these days, employers in all sorts of fields are realising just how good scientists are in general problem solving, that they know how to find out about a problem, they know how to work away at it, and then solve it. So I think people with science degrees are actually being sought after in all sorts of different things now, in consulting, in information technology, and in the stock market and in banking. So just say you choose to specialise in applied mathematics or marine science or inorganic chemistry or theoretical astrophysics, that's not going to mean that you're going to be stuck on that for the rest of your life. You're really going to be able to move into all sorts of different things. The other thing I think people really struggle with, at least I struggle with, is the perception that scientists are, and I really hate this word, but people use it in the media all the time, and that's that scientists are boffins. And that, I mean, there's a lot of connotations. I mean, you can use whatever word you want, boffin or nerd or geek or dweeb, whatever you want to use. There's a stereotype that scientists are socially inept, that we're out of touch, we're a bit weird, and, you know, we're just not normal people. And obviously this makes science a bit of a turn-off. Some people have turned away from a career in science because they want to fit in and they want to be an important member of society. And obviously, hopefully by looking at me and by me looking at you, we all realise that this stereotype is completely false. Scientists are actually... It might not come as news to you, but it comes as news to a lot of people in the greater Australian community that scientists are normal people. Although, I actually never wanted to be normal. I wanted to be more than that. But in any case, I mean, as you all know, we get down to the beach, we cheer on our favourite footy team, which are two things I haven't been doing while I've been living in Boston, but certainly when we're in Australia, we do that. We go to parties, we hang out with our friends, we make couch potatoes in front of the TV, we get married, we have families, all the things that normal people do, scientists do. And at the risk of being blatantly biased, I would actually claim that scientists are even more interesting, exciting people than everyone else. If you talk to a professional scientist, you find they're always very passionate about things like languages or arts or the music or the outdoors. I know that I take pleasure in all these things, and a lot of that pleasure is because of the appreciation of beauty and mathematics and order that my scientific training has given me, and you can actually enjoy everything around you just that much more because you understand what's going on. I think this is a very important point, actually. Science is useful, no one would argue about that, but we should never overlook the fact that science, particularly astronomy and space exploration, is interesting and it's beautiful and inspiring. If you ask most scientists why they spent all those years at university and why they work so hard now, it's not because they want to be famous, and it's not because they think they're going to win the Nobel Prize. It's because what they do is fascinating. My interest in astronomy began as a young boy when I was just breathtaken by how amazing the sky is at night. And getting to use some of the world's biggest telescopes to study that beauty in incredible detail is one of my main motivations today. So I've got this nice little cartoon to show you about that. Is there a related point there?
Give this thing another go.
So here's a little cartoon that I show to people and they ask me why I do what I do. Alright, so you can see all these people grumpy and stuck in traffic going to work in the big ugly city, and there's Truth and Beauty left lane. Well, there's me on my bicycle going off to study the stars. And hopefully if you're keen on science, that's the way you should feel about it too. It's truth and it's beauty, and I don't think there's any argument about that. Without wanting to get into issues of God and religion, because you all have your own opinions on that, I don't think there's any argument that the laws of physics and mathematics are simple and elegant, but at the same time, they're just endlessly subtle. It continually intrigues me, it keeps me awake at night, that pi, you know, the ratio of a circle's circumference to its diameter, is a number that just goes on forever. I mean, how can that be? It's this complexity within simplicity that fascinates scientists and really drives us to distraction as well. I think we find the same aesthetic and undefinable pleasure that's locked within Monet's lilies or Shakespeare's sonnets or Pachelbel's canon or whatever else it is that turns you on. We find that same pleasure and that same beauty buried within the molecules and the mathematical patterns and the galaxies that we work on. I think if we aspire to value diversity and beauty in all its forms, which is obviously a noble thing to aspire to, then there's nothing more diverse and there's nothing more beautiful than the universe around us.